You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
15 minutes after 11. Thank you so much for staying with us. I wanted to have a look at the Press Ombud ruling, and that is the ruling against Huffington Post SA. You will all probably by now be very familiar with the backstory to it, that there was a spoof, not so much a spoof, someone under false identity had written a blog in which they suggested that for a certain period of time, white men should not be allowed to vote, and perhaps that's a good mechanism to deal with the disproportionate global influence, and in particular here in South Africa, that white men historically has had over society. And then, of course, it turned out that, in fact, the person, Shelley Garland, doesn't exist, and that someone by the name of Marius Ruit had written this particular piece. Huffington Post then asked the Press Ombud to have a look at it. Also, there were various complaints to the Press Ombud, and the Press Ombud said that the editorial processes were clearly lacking. But the Press Ombud went further, and the part of the Press Ombud's judgment that has been particularly controversial has been the bit where the Press Ombud said that, in fact, quite apart from the identity being a problem of the person not being verified for who they are, and that being a lapse in the editorial process, that the blog itself constitutes hate speech. Hate speech. So, presumably, the Press Ombud means that even if Shelley Garland was a real person, actually existed, and had written the piece authentically, they would still find the piece to be hate speech. Now, I've got very strong views about this. I'm not a lawyer. I do keep abreast of constitutional law and elements of it in particular that have to do with questions around free speech, because it is of interest to me as a media practitioner and also just as someone with a legal theory background. And I think that the Press Ombud got it horribly wrong. But I wanted the voice of someone who's actually a legal counsel and someone who particularly specializes on when it comes to constitutional law and international law, of course, is Ben Winks, who is his own person. He's no one's sidekick. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Eusebius.
I don't even know where to start with this particular one. I think part of the problem, before we even get to your 100th, is that hate speech, from a legal point of view, seem to be fuzzy, and many lawyers that are good lawyers often disagree between themselves about what our sources of law and the Constitution has to say about hate speech.
Yes, there's a lot of confusion around the exact contents of hate speech because there are very different sources that prescribe what it means. So hate speech is a concept that originates in international law. It's not a South African concept. It came about after the Second World War, and particularly after the Holocaust. And the first person to be convicted and, in fact, executed for hate speech was Julius Streicher, who edited a newspaper that, in the lead-up and during the Holocaust, had published all kinds of caricatures and other denigrating characterizations and views about Jewish people. So this is where it comes from. And various human rights instruments adopted in the 40s and the 60s encouraged states to prohibit hate speech domestically. And what we have in South Africa is a carve-out in our constitution against the right to freedom of expression, saying that freedom of expression can never extend to propaganda for war, the incitement of imminent violence, or advocacy of hatred that is based on race, gender, ethnicity, or religion, and that constitutes incitement to cause harm. So we have there, you know, you've got international law, one source that's quite different to the Constitution, which is quite narrow because it requires an incitement to cause harm. And then you have our Equality Act, the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act, which takes it further. So beyond the absolute limit of free speech set by the Constitution, it imposes a further limit on free speech and says, well, anything that can be reasonably construed to be harmful on the basis of any of the prohibited grounds like race or gender would constitute hate speech. That's been subject to differing interpretations, not only by lawyers, but by courts as well. And then you have a fifth source, which is the press code itself, which defines hate speech quite differently as something, you know, language that is discriminatory or denigratory. Discriminatory or denigratory references to people's race, gender, etc., which is different from all of the above. So it's a complicated interpretive exercise. But because we're in South Africa and the Press Council is bound by South African law, it must interpret its own code consistently with the Constitution. So that's really where we should be bringing the discussion back to.
Is there the possibility that before we even ask whether Johann Retief applied his own code accurately to the facts at hand, that the code itself is overly broad potentially?
I think...
Or is it just a matter of being sensible when you try and make sense as the press ombudsman of what it means to denigrate someone, to advocate hatred? Because once we get to the core issue, the actual blog article that we're, you know, that's in the background to the first set of questions, that's going to be the key question. And it seems to me like one person has a view of what counts as advocacy of hatred, as denigration, and someone else will have a different view.
You expect people to interpret texts sensibly, reasonably, and in conformity with the purpose of the text, and also with the legislative framework being above all the Constitution. And Retief accepts that at the beginning of his ruling. He says, yes, no, we need to interpret this inconsistency with the Constitution. So in principle, it shouldn't be a problem. I mean, we shouldn't have to legislate every detail of what should be prohibited and what shouldn't. And you expect people to interpret these concepts consistently with the Constitution and with free speech.
Well, I mean, let's just get on and talk about the elephant in the room. So you have a white guy who's written a blog saying other white guys, presumably himself included, should temporarily be robbed of the right to vote as one mechanism for helping to reduce the impact of white supremacy in South Africa. I mean, that's the long and the short of it. How can that possibly meet the criteria for hate speech?
It's even Retief doesn't tell us, to be honest. So you look at his ruling, which is really just a ruling. It's not a set of reasons. It's a set of perfunctory conclusions, regrettably. So we can't even critically analyze what his reasoning is, because, I've got the ruling in front of me. What he says is that disenfranchisement of anybody is discriminatory. And the reasons given for this malicious suggestion certainly were denigratory. He doesn't investigate the meaning of these terms at all with reference to case law or anything else. What is discriminatory? What is denigratory? I mean, he could look, of course, at the definition in the dictionary. And interestingly enough, the definition of denigratory is to blacken or to make black, ironically enough, in the context of this case. And he then says, I do not believe that this statement needs any further justification. But of course it does. I mean, he's making an extraordinary judgment. And he says, well, I don't think this conclusion requires any further justification. So we are left to theorize as to what he understands by discriminatory and what's meant by denigratory. Now, discrimination, if we go again, back to international law, the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination specifically says that what is prohibited is the subjugation and segregation of marginalized or vulnerable groups. And specifically, there's a carve-out in that convention, in international law, that special measures taken to advance or protect previously disadvantaged people cannot constitute discrimination. In South Africa, we look at things slightly differently in the context of affirmative action and black economic empowerment, that it superficially could be seen as discrimination, but it's not unfair discrimination. In fact, it's constitutionally mandated. So simply to say that something is discriminatory because it differentiates is just step one in
the process of deciding whether it's justified discrimination or not. But even beyond that, Ben, I mean, there's a more basic problem here, surely, which is the article itself doesn't discriminate against white men. The article proposes discrimination against white men. Exactly. And that is a very important, not just grammatical distinction, a legal distinction. This article says, I hereby propose that we now discriminate against white men, which Johan Retief seems to be completely missing the point. You know what I mean? Mm. There's discrimination, and then there is, I propose that we discriminate. And that distinction is also one that you won't find anywhere in this ruling.
No, certainly. And
because if you propose discrimination, that is then a speech act that we can debate. Mm. We can put it in the public space. We can debate its merits. We can embarrass Shelley Garland for poor argumentation, which is exactly what has happened. And that, of course, is the basic foundation for why we try and interpret rules around what speech is permissible in a liberal society, so that we have maximum space for allowing even weak arguments to enter the public space where Ben and Eusebius can deconstruct it.
And I mean, if we interpret the blog article generously, at base it is saying that white males are disproportionately powerful. Now, I mean, that's not a racial caricature to say white males are disproportionately powerful, economically, socially, politically. So it's firstly not offensive. Secondly, it's not untrue. So on what basis it could be found that this is denigratory? I'm at the mercy of the press ombudsman.
I have no clue. And then he goes further. There's another piece of wording that comes into the press code here that I want your take on, which is this nebulous issue, right? And I know you lawyers like to think that it's precise, but the most honest law lecturer that I had was Professor Mitchley, who was the former dean of law at Rhodes. And one of my favorite phrases from him, I don't think he'll be happy that it's one of the few ones that I like quoting from him, because he was so much more than a funny lecturer, is that sometimes some of these phrases and their meaning depend on what a judge had for breakfast. Mm. And the same goes for a press ombud. The public interest.
Ah, yes.
Early on in this ruling, he also just waspishly says, it is not in the public interest to write a blog that says men shouldn't vote. White men shouldn't be allowed to vote. I mean, really? How does one determine public interest?
Well, firstly, he's asking the wrong question. What the press code says and what our common law says is not that your publication must be in the public interest. It's that you must be commenting on a matter of public interest. Undoubtedly, this was. It's commenting on disparities in economic, social, and political power and how to correct it. That's undoubtedly a matter of public interest. To say that the publication itself must be in the public interest is, firstly, not what the law requires, and secondly, is something that nobody is really in a position to judge, let alone to pass a sanction on. So, for example, Zapiro draws a cartoon. Ayanda Mabulu makes a painting. The content, I mean, the message is perhaps not in the public interest, but undoubtedly both are commenting on a matter of public interest, and that is why their speech is protected. It's not for an arbiter to decide that, well, this art or this cartoon or this article, in my view, is not taking us forward as a country. It's taking us backward. But this is what Retief says. He says that what's advocated in this article would take us backward. And that's not what he's called upon to decide.
Beautiful. I mean, I can listen to Ben the whole day. Brilliant. You've got a question for him. If there's an aspect of the ruling you don't understand, there's a bit more that I want us to work through, and we'll do so after the EWN news break. But if you've got a pressing question for him, give us a call on 011-883-0702 and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Also, let's have a bit of fun. If you are a media lawyer, a constitutional lawyer yourself, and you see it differently, we're also happy to debate it. It's not a perfect science. It is hermeneutics. And so maybe there's someone out there who thinks that there is a reading of the Constitution, of the press code, that is consistent with what Johan found. Ben and I are singing from the same hymn sheet. Maybe it's just us in our liberal pods. I don't know, but I really cannot see how you justify the remarks about public interest, why this is denigrating white men. I simply do not see it. And after this break, I want us to move on and have a little bit of a look at case law when it comes to also the notion of fair comment, because I think the public has a colloquial understanding of what fair comment is, and fair conjures up other synonyms like please don't hurt my feelings, but that's not what fair comment necessarily means in law. And in this particular ruling, as Ben obviously knows, there is a citation there that makes reference to a key constitutional case in McBride versus Citizen. And I think Johan, again, cites the right case, but takes the wrong lesson from Justice Edwin Cameron.
Eusebius is on Twitter, at Eusebius.
26 minutes before noon. Now, you know, what is quite interesting to me, Ben, is that fascinating case of McBride versus Citizen. And obviously that case centered, listeners may or may not recall, on whether if someone has been granted amnesty and therefore their record as previously in law being a murderer gets expunged, can I still refer to them in my publication as murderer or convicted murderer, even if I provide context? And in the end, there was a very important set of remarks that Justice Edwin Cameron made along the way in explaining why it is that fair comment should be interpreted as widely as possible to allow for all sorts of public debates, even if we don't necessarily, from an ethical or political or some other vantage point, you know, like what it is that was said in that comment. And I just want to read a couple of quotes, if I can pull that up quickly, from that judgment that for me is particularly key. So here's some of what Cameron J. had said in that particular case about fair comment, and fair comment is comment that is protected. He says, fair comment does not mean the following. Fair comment does not have to be, quote, just, equitable, reasonable, level-headed, and balanced. He goes further and he says, criticism will be protected, quote, even if extreme, unjust, unbalanced, exaggerated, and prejudiced, so long as it expresses an honestly held opinion without malice on a matter of public interest on facts that are true. Along the way, he says, for good, I think, linguistic reasons, that he actually prefers the phrase protected comment over the phrase fair comment. And then ends, you know, in paragraph 86 by saying the courts cannot prescribe what people may or should say. And I think where part of the problem comes in, Ben, is that although most law is couched in ordinary language, sometimes there is a departure between the meaning of a word or a phrase in everyday conversation and what legislators and judges and lawyers mean by it. When I say fair comment, some people said to me, how dare you say it's fair comment to say that the right to vote of white men should be taken away? That is so unfair. And it's because in everyday speech, they may have an intuitive sense that it's an unfair proposal. In law, what does fair comment mean?
Well, firstly, in my view, fair comment shouldn't have even come into this case. So it's not what is described in the press code under the heading of protected comment is comment on events or actions. You know, it's about you are lending your interpretation to something that has happened, to a certain set of facts. And it's the reason why this defense emerged was in the context of defamation, because individual reputations are concerned. This is more appropriately to be regarded as a form of advocacy rather than comment, which is Article 6 rather than Article 7 of the press code. And in fact, I mean, Retief himself found that it was, having found that it was advocacy of hatred, he should have realized that he was dealing with advocacy rather than comment. So a lot of the constructs of fair comment don't actually fit very very easily with this particular piece of writing, because it's not comment in the sense of in the term of art that's used in the law. The next issue now is whether or not. Let's assume that we can call it comment. There are certain elements of the defense of fair comment which are reiterated in the press code, but there's a lot of case law behind each of those terms. An important one is malice, and as you say, that has an ordinary meaning that, you know, if someone cuts in front of me in traffic, I think he's malicious towards me. And if someone says something nasty about me, the nastiness I could regard as malicious. And in this ruling, Retief comes to this conclusion without any citation of case law, without any analysis. He says, well, it's obviously malicious. But malice is a term in the law of defamation that means acting with an ulterior purpose in abuse of your right to freedom of expression. Now, what that means is that what you are saying is not really, what you are commenting on is not really what you are intending to comment on. So in McBride's case, it was alleged that in commenting on his suitability to be at that time the Ekurhuleni Metro police chief.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
They said, well, actually, you're just using that occasion and purporting to be commenting on that occasion, that event, as an opportunity to use the papers to express your personal hatred towards me. That's what he accused the citizen of doing. And Judge Cameron said there's nothing to show that they didn't genuinely want to comment on his suitability for appointment to that position, and that they were acting with ulterior purpose. Now, in this case, there's nothing to suggest objectively on the piece itself that it is not meant as a comment about how to address the disproportionate power that white males have enjoyed and do enjoy in the South African economy. There's nothing to suggest that this is actually just about some racist feeling towards white men or sexist feeling towards white men. But that it is actually a comment about what it says it is, which is about power.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. I take your first point, I think, is very important. It was weird that the case was cited, quite apart from the fact that I think that it got wrong, the analysis of those different elements. I just want to ask you slightly more widely, what, you know, obviously Fereshny has decided, it seems, not to appeal this particular ruling by the Ombud. The executive director, Joe Tlolo, has now tried to make a special request, I see this morning, to see whether he might be allowed to do so. And I mean, I don't know what the law is to say about that. In these kinds of dispute resolution mechanisms, is it only the persons who were involved as the primary subjects who can appeal this kind of thing or not?
In principle, yes. If we were dealing with litigation in court, we would be in a very unfortunate position in that if the parties or if the losing party has already complied with the order, then they can't appeal against it because it's become moot. They have, in the terms we use, have preempted the appeal. Mm. So once Huffington Post published the apology, which they did immediately, no appeal was possible by them.
Okay.
So what quite in I think a sterling display of leadership and foresight, what Joe Tlolo has done is has written to the appeals body and said, well, I feel that this ruling needs to be appealed. It can't be appealed by either of the parties. And I believe that I have standing to appeal it because as among my functions, I'm supposed to safeguard the interests of the Press Council, and I have the power to initiate complaints before the Press Council, so before the Press Ombud. So I should also have the power to initiate appeals. Mm. And it's because we're not dealing with strict formalistic rules of court, the appeal body is entitled to take a flexible approach to this. If they don't, then there is another avenue, which is for the executive director, because he does have standing. He does have a direct and material interest in the outcome of this matter. He could take it on review to court. Mm. So that's the other remedy if the appeals body doesn't hear it.
Do other media bodies, and I know this is a bit left field, but just your gut at least as a very good lawyer, do other media have potential standing in that kind of scenario? For example, here's where I'm going with this. Mm. News 24, as far as I'm concerned, dropped the ball. They should be deeply ashamed of themselves. They should have supported Fereshny. They should have appealed this ruling. It's a bad ruling. She should have apologized to her viewers. They should have put mechanisms in place to prevent oversight where people can falsely give them material and maybe give her some guidance with a senior editor. Okay, but that's my view on how they should have handled it. But the fact that they're not appealing it means that in theory, that a precedent has now been set based on this incredibly poorly reasoned ruling from the Press Ombud. If I were to write, I don't know, a blog entry, put it, ask Mail and Guardian to publish exactly the same thing, then presumably I would be falling foul of the Press Ombud's ruling. So as a writer, as a journalist, as media houses, we all surely have a direct interest professionally in what happens to this sitting president that is a bad president.
Yeah, what's required to give someone standing to review a decision is that they are directly and materially affected by it. So any member of the press council, which would be any of the major newspapers, including online newspapers, would have standing to take it on review. Because, of course, it regulates their future behavior. It has an immediate chilling and narrowing effect on what they can publish tomorrow and the next day and next week.
Mm. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Ben, love your work, love your insights. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.